This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Joining us this morning are Colin Moore, an associate professor of political science and director of the Public Policy Center at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and Jim Shawn, former Peace Corps teacher, 12-year state legislator, and longtime legislative observer, currently the director of the Hawaii Educational Policy Center. Welcome to you both.
Pleasure to be here.
You know, we're seeing a lot of ads against the ConCon, but Colin, why don't we start out with your efforts to kind of clearly lay out what's at stake with this citizens jury that you helped to organize?
Sure. So the Public Policy Center was interested in how average citizens thought about this very complex issue. And so what we created was what we've called a citizens jury. And this is similar to other initiatives done mainly in Oregon. But the idea is pretty simple. It's imagine you take a representative sample of citizens like we do when we poll folks, but then you give them the opportunity to really learn about the issue in a way that often they don't have the opportunity to do. So we selected 18 people, mainly from the neighborhood boards. We met for 3 evenings, and these folks had an opportunity to learn all about the history of ConCon from 1978, all of the things that might be involved. They heard arguments from people who were in favor of it, who were against it, and then they all got a chance to get together and deliberate and talk about what they saw as the most important arguments for it, against it, and a series of facts that they could settle on. And all of this is on the public policy website at UH, which you can Google and find pretty easily. And at the end of the day, 12 of them decided that they did want a ConCon, and 6 were opposed to it, which I think is an interesting result. Now, obviously, this isn't a poll, so you can't think of it that way. But it does show, I think, that there is a lot of interest in this idea from average citizens, whereas most special interest groups, from the unions to environmental lobbies, I mean, pretty much everyone in the political class of this state is opposed to it. So I think it does illustrate that there's this interesting split between citizens and maybe our leaders on this issue.
So what was the final report?
So the final report was a series of arguments that they thought were persuasive, that the people who were for it thought were persuasive, and possible arguments against it. And so those arguments really were, for those in favor of it, the idea that this would reestablish trust in government, it would get people interested in participating again, because really a ConCon is a grand show. I think the other one that they found really persuasive was this would be an opportunity to take a holistic look at our constitution, at our system of government, in a way that you can't in a very short legislative session making small changes on the margins. You know, there's a couple of other issues that really interest them. The first was term limits. That's an idea that's been discussed for decades, but I think there's a lot more support for that, and this is something the people in favor of it were interested in. Maybe a way to clarify the role of OHA and to clarify other Native Hawaiian rights. They thought that would be a reason to have a ConCon. And then to put the initiative, referendum, and recall system on the ballot here in Hawaii. We're the only Western state that doesn't have that, so it's pretty unique. On the other side, I think it really was motivated by their fears of what could happen. And I think you see this reflected in a lot of the media and the ads against this, which is that, first, there might not be enough safeguards to really protect us from extreme or special interests that might try to dominate the delegate selection, and then dominate the election that happens after that, after the convention is finished meeting. And so all of these rights that we think of are important, Native Hawaiian rights, the rights, collective bargaining rights, things like that really might be eroded during a ConCon if you believe this argument that special interest groups or others who want to attack those might become influential. I think the second is a fear that people aren't going to take this seriously enough, that when after the convention meets and when these amendments appeared on the ballot, it would be, it would be too easy for people not to really understand exactly what they're voting on. So again, there's too much to lose. And so I think that's really what motivated the voters who opposed. And I think that's pretty representative of how this is broken down in the community. I mean, the hope, what really could happen with this grand experiment in democracy, and the fear that, well, we have a pretty progressive and good constitution right now. Maybe we shouldn't mess with it.
Right. And we've heard that, right? If it's not broke, don't fix it. I mean, did anything surprise you, Jim, about this report?
Well, you know, as the ghost of the 70s, I haven't been in the CONCON. The first thing is that many of the hopes seem to be unconnected with what you do in a constitution. Mm-hmm. I've heard people argue, you know, the potholes, we have to fix the potholes, all kinds of ancillary things that are clearly not constitutional for a fix. The issue of even term limits, this year 20% of the House and the Senate will change. 20% just in 1 year, right? You know, lots of people are not really familiar with that. Mm-hmm. Lots of people are not familiar that since the last CONCON, there have been 72 separate amendments put before the public. And the public has been very, you know, discerning and discriminatory with these. 30% have failed, right? So it's not that we have not had opportunities. And you know, in 78, we bundled all these amendments together, and they all basically, you know, survived as one kind of big bundle. But when you do one or two at a time, as we're finding with the debate over the CONAMP for Education, there's a lot more in-depth discussion about one or two amendments, right? The other thing that really is important to me is this notion of what's been happening in the community, and is the CONCON a place to have an initial conversation? In the 70s, you had, in 1970 and 74, a huge debate between the Burns-Ariyoshi world and the Gill-Fossey world. We built Magic Island with the idea of putting hotels on it.
That's right.
It was a huge environmental debate. We had, unbeknownst to many delegates, a huge discussion in the Hawaiian community that was going on leading up to the CONCON, building off of the Hawaiian Renaissance. They were debating how to move sovereignty forward in ways that most of us were not even aware of. There was an open government debate. I remember lobbying for the first sunshine law in the early 70s. You know, Common Cause was created at the time. And on Oahu, the neighborhood boards were created. These were average citizens designing how many members of the board, designing how you would vote for them. In Waikiki, the voting places were in condos. And designing a whole variety of these, running for neighborhood board for the first time, being elected to that board, and ultimately generating a lot of candidates for the CONCON itself. So you had all this percolating. People were marching down Waiholi, Waikani Valley to save the valley from, you know, development. You had balanced budget discussions. And if you looked at the data book in the 70s, every significant number tripled. Tourism, government revenue. We were happy. We were building roads. We were building the university. It was fun to be involved with government, right? So you had this context of richness going on in the community with a lot of agendas that were already well developed before there was a CONCON, right? Today, I personally don't see that. I see little smatterings of grumblings and wouldn't it be neat if we did this and do that, but I don't really see where the community is as well engaged. You know, in part it's because we are a more mature society. We built the university, we built this, you know, we got the roads, we got H3, all these sort of things going on. We saved Magic Island, you know, and we have a water code, and we have a number of these that matured out of that, right? And so then you have to ask, what is the conversation, no pun intended, going on in the community that is generating significant, well-thought-out agendas that might be appropriate for a constitution? I may be biased, but I'm not really seeing that energy there. And, you know, that energy at the time is what, for with no legal thing involved, pushed out all elected officials. And almost, you know, a very small number of people had ever been elected to anything. They were elected to the CONCON. Now you have, you know, Citizens United. You have local groups. You have even special groups on the CONAMP. putting a lot of money into this and a lot of money into that, that seems to be confusing and muddying the water for people. I personally think that the issue of the CONCON and the issue of the CONAM may be confused in people's minds, you know. And certainly, I have my pet amendments if we had, you know, a CONCON. You know, I'd like to see the lieutenant governor do something, you know. But apart from little pet, you know, individual agendas, the likelihood of people having read the Constitution and read other constitutions to understand what that is and what its role is. You know, Legislative Reference Bureau did a whole series of very intense studies. And before even I ran, I was hired to do all the studies on the environment and Hawaiian affairs, right? These were in-depth studies. The League of Women Voters were doing studies. Lots of stuff going on, right? I don't see that kind of educational effort going on. The Office of Elections has said it's not our job to educate voters. They've said that very explicitly, right? We put no money into that. So I'm not, you know, and given our great voter turnout, I'm not seeing the energy that you would want to have for a very productive, you know, convocation, if you want. And I may be biased, you know, I'm living in the past, as we all are, right? But I see wonderful things that could happen, you know, a 21st century teleconference, you know, kind of a model for democracy, if it happened. But as far as agendas, I'm not seeing a coherent set of even sub-agendas that you would bring to the Constitution and change it.
We have been seeing ads against the CONCON, and one of them is, you know, anti-driving in her car, saying, well, it, you know, LRB says it's going to cost $50 million, and, you know, what else could we do with that money? I don't see any ads to counter.
No, there isn't. As far as I'm aware, there isn't a group that has picked up on this and is in favor of it. I mean, so if you do have this collection of interests that's opposed to it, I mean, and cost, I think people, they often use cost because that seems to be the, you know, the easiest thing for voters to understand about why you might want to not have it. It's just a whole lot of money, and who knows what's going to happen. But I mean, Jim raises all these other good points, which is that it's not really clear what anyone wants to achieve from this. But despite that, there's a whole lot of people who do think that this is a good idea. I mean, and I think this gets at, you know, I've kind of termed this the local malaise. I mean, there's tremendous frustration about the what appears to be the inability of the state government to solve a lot of these problems. I mean, I'll give you an example of that. So the Public Policy Center at UH just did a poll in August, and we asked a variety of questions, but some standard questions about, for example, how do you approve of the state legislature? Only 21% approved of the state legislature. That is very, very low. In fact, that's 1 percentage point lower than the U.S. Congress. And our state legislature is dominated by Democrats in a Democratic state. You might think they might perform better than the Republican U.S. Congress, but in fact, they don't. So I think when you hear people say they support the idea of CONCON, I think it's this sense that the current system is somehow broken. How do they want to change it? I don't think they know. But they know that they're upset with the status quo.
And we do have a written question that just popped up. They ask, could you go over what a CONCON is? define it, please.
That is a great question. I'm going to turn that over to Jim since he was actually in a CONCON.
Yeah. A CONCON is a separate election of delegates, right, which can be create, you know, the legislature usually has to frame this so they can decide how many, how districts will be created, if there's a time frame for it, what education it might go for it, but you have an election of delegates, and they are elected for a very short period of time to convene and given the power to discuss whatever they want. They could convene and do nothing, right? But they could usually convene, and they make proposed constitutional amendments, which would be put on the ballot and voted, presumably at a general election. Doesn't have to be a general election. Could be an all mail-in separate election. You know, could be. We have a lot more options actually today than we might have in the past, right? And so, you know, part of the issues is, Could there be restrictions on who runs for CONCON? Could an elected official be denied the right? You know, if you're already elected, you can't do this. How much you should pay for them? Where would you have it? I personally believe the $55 million is an outrageously exaggerated number. In 78, it was $5 million, right? We had 102 delegates, right? We did have the advantage of using the old federal building, which is, you know, the post office and whatnot, which is kind of empty, right? So when you start adding, oh, maybe you pay people $10,000 here or whatnot, the notion that it would be 10 times as more expensive is a little bit outrageous. Probably 15 to 20 million might be the outside. Now, people could object, that's nothing to sniff at, right? But it's not as exaggerated. So in any case, you are electing people to propose amendments, right? And those delegates, just like the legislature today, can frame how those amendments are described. And it's very interesting. We have this lawsuit before
That's right.
The Supreme Court. Personally, I think this is absurd, because the notion that you would quibble over the word investment and tax and whatnot, and have in your mind judicially what is an average voter and what do they know, this is a slippery slope if you're going to say that the people who have the power to craft the amendment and the description are going to be so way off. I suppose you could describe an amendment that has nothing to do with the amendment, right? You know, maybe that might be something. But if it's just a matter of assuming, you know, what would an average voter think and whatnot, this is, come on. And part of the debate is, as provided by law in this CONAM, the state constitution is riddled with as provided by law, which means you don't know what that law might be, right? The notion that people can't anticipate down the road what might happen with this is not a reason to say it's a flawed question, right? You know, but nevertheless, it does seem to be an issue. On the mainland, there have been challenges to the way amendments have been, you know, described, if they were so far off or not, you know. But it is not, in many ways, that CONCON is like the legislature, is they can decide and vote on whether or not a specific proposal will go on a ballot. They do not get to decide if it will pass or not, right? But now you have timing, right? So suppose you had a CONCON between May and August, right? Then you have a very short period of time for the educational worlds, the Colin Moores and the LRBs and anybody else, to educate the public as to what this range of amendments might mean for them, and whether they're appropriate and all that sort of thing. We tend not to put up money for electoral education anymore, so I'm not sure how that would work. But in the end, it will be the voters looking at a long list of stuff as they go into the voting booth, as to whether they're for or against it. We have this happening regularly. 72 amendments since 78 have been put on the ballot, and a whole slew of charter amendments in many of the counties, right? You know, and you had the GMO thing going on, and you know, you have a lot of grassroots efforts, right? And in many cases, the great dream of having this direct democracy has not transformed democracy. You know,
That's right. I mean, and this idea of the CONAM, I think, does give you an illustration of what voters would face on a much, much larger scale if there were a CONCON. It wouldn't just be one amendment where there's some questions. Do people know what a surcharge is? Do they know what real property is? I mean, it would be many, many of them deciding these things. On the other hand, though, I mean, some of the younger participants in this citizens' jury that we participated in kept saying, well, why don't you trust us? I mean, why don't we trust voters? Why don't we trust the process to elect reasonable delegates who are going to take this seriously, who are going to craft amendments that make that make real sense to normal voters. It worked in 1978. I mean, and it just, I think Jim mentioned this, but I mean, so many things came out of this. Term limits for the governor and the lieutenant governor, our balanced budget requirement, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, most famously. I mean, and some things that didn't quite work out. I mean, there were partially publicly financed elections. We do have that, but I don't think it quite took on the significance that some people thought it might. But it does give you this opportunity, this unique opportunity, to look at everything at once. I mean, to gather people together, probably 102, and really try to fix the system rather than just working around the edges, which is what you have now.
Okay, we do have to take a break. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. The hot topic today, the Hawaii Constitution, do we need to revisit it? You can join the discussion by calling 1-877-941-3689. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break.
I'm Ira Plato. One out of three babies born in the U.S. is delivered via C-section, and the rate in some countries is even higher. On the next Science Friday, a look at what's behind the rise of C-sections and what this means for healthy babies and their mothers. Plus, how farmers in Puerto Rico are rebuilding 1 year after Hurricane Maria. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon from 1 to 3. Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Wealth Jar, Hawaii Pacific University, and Locations.
You are back with The Conversation, and today we're talking about the ConCon. We reached out to various groups on this issue. Christian Fern of the University of Hawaii Professional Assembly said this.
We realize there are many who would welcome the opportunity to participate as a delegate in the Constitutional Convention so that they can speak out their concerns and help shape some of the state's policy agenda. However, we haven't heard any compelling reason or specific areas of the Constitution that they want to try and revise. Legislative Reference Bureau study indicates that it could cost up to $55 million. We believe $55 million would be better spent tackling other issues instead of trying to rehash them over again in an expensive forum. Attempting to tamper with the Constitution, invite special interest aimed at eroding collective bargaining, health care, and public pension rights that are possibly threatened. Although we believe that those are areas that are a part of the fabric of Hawaii, we believe that these special interest groups may see this as an opportunity to target those areas, which could negatively impact the public sector employees as well as employees in general in the state going into the future.
And we do have a number of public government unions opposing this. HGA, I think, is funding ads on the air. Reaction to this, protecting power?
Well, yes, of course. It's protecting power. It's protecting rights. It's protecting our sort of political culture in Hawaii, what we value. I must object, though, that there have been some certain other media groups that have criticized being against the ConCon as you must be corrupt if you're not for the ConCon. There are many legitimate concerns, and they're not all just protecting your turf issues, right? You know, and with Citizens United, this is not, actually, I think even back in 78, one of the reasons why so many people were reluctant to accept initiative was this notion that we were subject to an enormous amount of investment coming into the state that was, you know, new hotels, new development, all this sort of thing. If that were applied to the political process, right, would they be able to really use initiative against us? And in many other states, what people do is they put initiatives on the ballot to pump up their own voter base. You know, we've seen this for socially conservative groups who will put like an abortion issue on the thing because they want to get their people out to vote, whether or not it passes or not. You know, so that I always was for initiative. I thought it was an important safety valve. But there are legitimate concerns that should not be just dismissed as, oh, you're just protecting the same power base.
Well, we did have the Janus decision recently, and I know Labor is concerned that you open this up and you're going to get a lot of the groups' outside money coming in to influence what happens here locally.
I think that's right. I mean, that's precisely their concern. Although I think for a lot of voters, with when you have this coalition of the public sector unions coming together to oppose it, I think some of them think, well, maybe it is a good idea. I mean, maybe if these entrenched interests are against it, it's something I should be for. And so it cuts both ways. The other thing I'll say is that it's interesting to me how little faith we seem to have in the process. And, I'm neither for or against the con, but I think it is interesting that fear seems really to be motivating the opposition to a con. Remember, there will be three separate elections, one to decide whether or not we should have it, one to elect the delegates, and then a final one, which will allow voters to vote up or down the various amendments. So there's plenty of opportunities to stop this or influence it in the process. And if we elect 102 delegates, which I think would be likely, I mean, you're talking about two delegates per House district. And, I think it's pretty unlikely, to be perfectly honest, that you're going to be electing people who somehow are representatives of dangerous special interests. I mean, these will have to be your friends and neighbors. I mean, it's going to be a relatively low turnout election. It'll be based on going door to door, handing out some material. I mean, it's not going to be, almost certainly, if politicians themselves don't run, which I think is unlikely, they are really going to be local members. I mean, the sort of people who run for your neighborhood board. And I'm not sure it's fair to say that those sorts of people are captured by special interest groups, or the people who would be delegates, somehow would be part of some corrupt bargain. I think most of them really would want to do what they thought was best for the state.
I'm just curious, since you were one of the 102, how many out there are still alive and kicking like you, and who would maybe join in this process?
Well, I don't know about former delegates. You know, I mean, I think a lot of us are, just as we got the baton passed to our generation, which was a very proactive generation, much more engaged than, you know, we had Vietnam, we had civil rights, all
right,
that kind of stuff, than a younger group right now. But I would point out that the range of competitors per delegate was between 6 and 20 for every delegate. That means almost nobody was elected with a majority, mm-hmm, right? And it also meant if you had any little nudge, a little extra money from a union or you ran for neighborhood board, you had some edge, the likelihood of you getting elected in a 34% turnout, right, with people waving on every corner, nobody knew who all these people were, you know, that was important. But I think it's also important is that part of the narrative about this is some fantasy that the people who would elect delegates are different voters who elect the legislature today, right? If you're dissatisfied with, you know, Congress, the president, you know, our legislature, what are the voters doing that they're voting for this, right? The voters are repeatedly voting for the current legislature and making those decisions on a regular basis, right? These are the same voters. They're not, you know, con voters off on the side ready to run in and do something different, right, you know? And so if indeed you did have the ability of existing elected officials, right, given all this other stuff around, you can imagine lots of existing politicians, electeds, and corporations putting up their candidates, saying, "Representative Sean, you got to run because you got to protect these things that you got to protect
right.
The environment. You're an environmentalist. You can't leave it to just anybody who wanders off the street. Okay, I'll run." You know. So I mean, I think there's a lack of, you know, maybe thoughtful appreciation of how the democracy is working right now, and the decline of voters, and the you know, if you look at the last couple of years, the great hope was that the folks brought in by Bernie, you know, Bernie Sanders would be engaged. There's no evidence of that. There's no even evidence of when Obama was on the ticket that there was a huge surge of younger voters as well. So the engagement of the progressives, it's our turn, right, which is a very legitimate thing. Okay, new generation, new ideas, right? They are not nearly as persistently engaged. And there's a kind of flash mob democracy that social media is producing, where people are not necessarily joining a group or a party, but they're joining a, you know, a thing on Facebook or whatnot, you know. And once that's over, fine, I go off and do my thing, right? And I think the lack of attachment to institutions is something to think about in our democracy. And it's one of the unfortunate weaknesses of upcoming generations who are less trusting of a party, of an organization, to belong to it for a period of time, you know, and so the in and out of this engagement does not, to me, argue that the next generation is stepping up. Maybe that's unfair, but I think the stats show that.
We did hear from the Sierra Club. Colin Yost had this to say about our Constitution.
We make it very clear that all public natural resources are held in trust by the state for the benefit of the people. And that concept of a public trust is incredibly important in Hawaii law. The Constitution is part of the reason why it is so strong and has had such an impact in many judicial decisions in the state. There are a number of other provisions, important ones, in the state constitution that have had very important effects on to benefit the environment in Hawaii. It's been involved in cases where the constitution has prevented large landowners from diverting unlimited amounts of water from our streams. It has required the state to ensure that the military is cleaning up after its training exercises. It's protected limu beds on Molokai Spring on Kauai, Kalalo'i on Maui, and many other places. If anything, I think that we could start to look more closely at how the state constitution could help us address the greatest challenges that we're currently facing, and the greatest of all, of course, is climate change. We need to think broadly and think in radical and urgent ways on how we can try to protect our state from the global threat that climate change brings. That's an enormous challenge.
So what do you think? Do you think climate change can be worked into the Constitution?
Well, I think it would certainly be a big part of the discussion if we were to have a con. I mean, in the same way that the Sierra Club, I think, was reacting to their fear that this really unique public trust water rights doctrine is enshrined in our Constitution, that they could lose that. You could also expand it pretty dramatically. I mean, even compared to the 70s, where in 1978, people really were in that period, shockingly, concerned about the environment. Today, much more so. And so I think that there is an opportunity, perhaps, if you're an environmentalist, to say, well, we can expand it. If you like the public trust doctrine, we can make it even better in a new con. I mean, I think that's how someone who would be in favor of this would react. And I think that's true of every single issue you bring up. I mean, it's... you're either worried that those rights are going to be eroded, or you think that there's hope to expand them or to change them or to make them even better. And I think the reaction, particularly among younger progressives, and I take Jim's point that it's not clear how much people would be involved and if you really would get the same sort of interest you had in 1978. But I think they say, look, look what you did in 1978. A lot of that was unexpected. I mean, the Hawaiian issues in particular, nobody really saw that going into 1978. I mean, maybe some people, but I think that the importance of that took in 1978 was unexpected, and it was a result of so many young people like Jim at the time who ran and injected those new ideas into our Constitution.
We do have a caller on the line, Frank from the Big Island from Mountain View. Oh, gosh, I think we may have just lost him. We did have another listener write in. Mary Ann Oros wrote into our talkback line. She said that she's been thinking about the con vote, talking with folks, and surprised at the number of her friends who intend to vote no. She says that she moved here in 73, was a 27-year-old from the Bay Area, and she thought the con was exciting for a great opportunity for public input. It turned out that most people in Hawaii not only approved of the effort, but voted to approve all 34 of the constitutional amendments proposed. The con was a roaring success. I've been surprised that the voters of Hawaii have declined to vote for another con since 1978. Now we have yet another opportunity for grassroots changes, organized grassroots changes. Surprisingly, opposing the con this year are many of the same groups that benefited from the last con. The Sierra Club, our environment benefited greatly from the con. Council of Native Hawaiian Advancement, Hawaiians have greatly benefited. The Democratic Party, any Republicans around? Labor unions, both governmental and private industry, labor unions have thrived, especially government workers. She adds, shame on the ACLU. The ACLU is supposed to fight for the rights of freedom and thought and speech.
Well, everything she says is true, but, and that is that there are many assumptions with that. And it is the nature of any document, state, society, that, once you have reached a plateau of structure and rights and framework, right, then the notion that you want to revisit this all the time, my analogy is along these lines. Guy walks into a bank and he says, I want a $500,000 loan. I want to hire an architect and a structural engineer for my house. The banker says, oh, what do you want to do? And he says, well, I'm not happy with the decor in my living room and, the couches, the rugs, And the banker says, well, you don't need all these people for that. What else is in the matter? Well, I really need a new kitchen. The appliances are old. Well, maybe you need a kitchen, an extra loan for the kitchen thing, right? But in the end, is your house falling apart? Is the basement cracking? Is the roof leaking? Do you want to actually put a new thing on the house, right? I can't give you a loan, for all these little things. The things inside the house is what the legislature does all the time that you need to change, right? You need that flexibility year in and year out. But you don't necessarily change the entire structure and architecture of the house because you're unhappy with what's going on in the house. Now, maybe this is an exaggerated metaphor, but to me, I think a lot of people have concluded the house is basically sound. What we are pissed off with is what's going on in the house, right? In the ledge, in the electorate, in the policies, who's being elected? Do we have the guts to have the right policies? Is the airport a state-of-the-art airport? All these little frustrations, right, which don't have to do with the structure of the house.
And I think that's what motivates people who are for this, though, is that they would say, I've been asking them to make these upgrades to the house for years, and they won't do it. I mean, it's like I have this terrible contractor. I keep calling him, and he never returns my phone calls.
And I want
I think,
term
I think
limits.
That's how people feel about the legislature. Now, Jim, of course, is right that these people can vote for different members of the legislature, and there's no guarantee that the delegates would be different. But I think what's attractive is the con, you can run around the legislature. I mean, I think in some ways it may just be a romantic dream that you get these non-politicians together and everyone comes together and they make these institutional reforms like term limits, like the initiative system, maybe devolving more power to the counties that politicians, because they benefit from the status quo, won't make.
And we did also reach out to the ACLU. Josh Wish said this on behalf of the organization End Preserve Our Hawaii, which is a diverse coalition of organizations representing the business, labor unions, and environmental groups. The group urges residents to vote no on the ballot question.
There are a number of ways that people's individual rights and liberties are explicitly protected in the Hawaii Constitution that are not as explicit in the U.S. Constitution. And there are other ways to make some of the changes folks would like to see in our laws, either through statutory changes or through the CONAM process. And with those other options, the ACLU position is that it's not worth jeopardizing our core rights by doing the type of wholesale surgery on the Constitution that could occur in a CONCON. And here's just one timely example. So the Hawaii Constitution specifically includes a right to privacy in its text. And here's one reason that's so important for us to protect. We all watched the hearings to confirm now Justice Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court. One of the things that was a central part of that debate was whether he would provide the necessary vote to overturn Roe versus Wade, the case that provides the nationwide protection for a woman's right to choose how to control her own body. And what some people might not realize, though, is that the basis for the Supreme Court's decision in Roe was the right to privacy. And that's a right that is not specifically drafted into the United States Constitution, but that the U.S. Constitution has been interpreted to include, and that now there are real fears could be rolled back. And again, that right to privacy, however, is explicitly written into the Hawaii Constitution. So in the turbulent times in which we currently find ourselves, we need to maintain protections like that that are in our guiding document here in Hawaii. And once a CONCON is convened, there's really no limit to the type of changes that can be made. And the ACLU position is that we shouldn't endanger those rights by opening them up to such blanket changes.
And I should say that that was, I think, a concern that our caller who was on the line, Frank from Mountain View, was expressing.
Let's assume for a moment that we're probably all wrong and they vote for a CONCON. You know? and so, you know, what could it look like, right? You know, whether you think it's a good idea or not. You know, the first thing is that I would suggest is that I thought 102 delegates was too many. Why? Because the larger the group, the more hierarchical the group, right? Mm-hmm. And the less of a really thorough discussion. So if I were designing this, I would do 51, one for each, you know, House district. I would put it in a place like the convention center where you could force a lot of free parking. And I would have hyper high tech where people could testify from every neighbor island with teleconferencing, to really upgrade our notion of what an open, democratic, engaged society is, right? That so rather than focus on the agenda, I might focus on what does democracy look like in the information age. You know, you couldn't really do it at the Capitol because they are way behind in this kind of technology. You know, there's only one or two rooms where somebody can testify from the neighbor islands. You know, that's ridiculous, right? People are laughing at that, right? You know, you could do it on your laptop, for Pete's sakes, right? And to be able to really engage a lot of people to do ongoing rolling polling during a CONCON, you know, here's a proposal. Let's do a poll out there, you know, that's some validity, right? So that delegate, you know, most legislators and certainly delegates have no idea what their constituents think on 99% of the bills before they vote on them. You know, people work during the day. They don't testify. To be able to really open this up and get a sense of the community in a high-tech 21st century way might be a very interesting thing to do. Where you have it, how accessible it is for parking, for technology, would be one of the kinds of things I would really want people to take seriously. And if it's legally possible, I would bar any elected official from running, because it's a kind of dual thing, you know, collecting twice, that sort of thing. So I think you can imagine, you know, this twinkly barner, you know, thing out there that is very attractive if you vote for it. Whether the ledge will try to create that kind of a thing is, you know, debatable, right? But you could imagine where this could be a procedural engagement opportunity if it happened, right?
And if you did it right, it could really help reestablish some trust in government. I mean, if it was transparent, if people did have a feeling that they were their testimony was being taken seriously, if it did become this grand experiment in what's possible, you know, and at the same time usher in a new generation of political leaders like it did in 1978.
And here's the thought. What if we experimented and did the balloting online?
Yes. Not only would I do the balloting for the delegates all online and through the mail, I would have a special election just on the CONCON,
mm-hmm.
not overlapping with all the other stuff, you know, for electing officials, because then you get it in the mail. It could have not only a description of the amendment, but the actual amendment. It could have educational materials associated with it. It could actually help people if they wanted to, right? But Colin, I would disagree with one thing. And that is that the notion that a lot of people testifying would feel that they had more faith in government, the more likely thing is I testified and nobody paid attention.
That's a good point.
There you go.
They voted against what
right.
I wanted. You know,
they didn't listen.
They didn't listen, right? And everybody thinks that their testimony and their voice is so compelling.
So brilliant.
So brilliant, right? And not really understanding that elected officials of any stripe are hearing a huge amount of very well thought out, you know, information coming in for every proposal that and you never see that.
Well, I think that's actually a pretty good idea. So has anyone proposed it to the Office of Elections? to do the online balloting? I mean,
well,
I don't know.
In my fantasy world, if it passed, I would give this entirely to the Lieutenant Governor.
Ah, there you go.
That would
give them something to do.
Give them something to do. Let them create a special committee with all the bells and whistles. They have to collaborate with the Office of Elections and things like that, because you know who votes and whatnot. But this whole notion that you want to impinge on them, they're already telling us we don't have enough money and enough people to even do a good election, you know, really clear and all that.
To do an educational sample ballot.
That's right. So let somebody who has nothing to do do this, right? You know, and it actually would be a very positive, you know, thing. And any elected lieutenant governor is going to want to make this turn out well, you know. So I would not give it to the usual suspects in my fantasy world. That doesn't mean a CONCON is a good idea. But if we passed, there is a slight opportunity here that we could be innovative, creative, far-reaching, you know, 21st and a half century.
Here, hon ho, right? And, you know, and of course we've got this dilemma. If people leave it blank, it counts as no.
That's right. Everyone at least who's listening should know that leaving it blank is effectively is a no vote for the CONCON. And I think it's pretty unlikely that it's going to pass. I mean, we saw some polling recently that every time Civil Beat has done this poll about a CONCON, the numbers go down because they're hearing from these groups who are opposed to it. People are beginning to think, well, it sounded neat, but there's really a lot at stake here, a lot to lose.
So it's the fear factor.
It's the fear factor. And I think there actually is, as Jim mentioned earlier, some honest confusion between the CONAM and the CONCON. So remember, those are two entirely separate issues that you'll be voting on in November.
And I think it's important to recognize, recently we've both been involved with this idea that civic education in Hawaii, whether it be K-12 or even at the university, is pretty pathetic.
It is.
I recently testified to the Board of Regents. The mission had, you know, they were a public university. The mission has no mention of democracy or developing the next generation of engaged, informed voters. We don't require any courses, right? The DOE is kind of limped along. They can't even tell you, are you taking American history in the ninth grade or the 12th grade? You know, 12th grade mind is different than a ninth grade mind. And a sophomore or junior in college is a different, mature person, right? We have taken no public policy that says we take seriously the role of public education in civic education, right? And oh, we don't have room for it, and oh, it's their job, pointing fingers, hot potato. But we are now sitting in a world in which our state government has not taken seriously that importance of education, where you present the information, it's understood, you make people remember it, and you help people apply it, you know, and that's true of anything, but particularly for public civic education.
So we can't keep doing the same thing over and over again and expect the same outcome, or try and change the outcome. We need to do something different.
Well, yeah, but I think one of my concerns is that this community is not ready to have an educated, informed debate.
Because we've invested so little in civic education.
That's right. And now you can't even count on five people going to the same websites or seeing the same news. We're all atomized. And this is why Facebook and Twitter have manipulated elections in the past, because there's no context for any of this, right? And just an anecdote, a couple years ago, I was teaching a course in Masters of Social Work, right? These are more mature students. They're all working, and it was social policy, right? And we were talking about Title IX, you know, where you have equity. And I asked people, raise your hand if you've ever heard or the name Patsy Mink. Mm. And not a single hand went up.
Wow.
Right? Now, this is a more mature group. And they were almost proud not to have soiled their minds with political issues. Right? You know, I'm serious, right? And this was a very sad thing to recognize, right? But you have an entire generation that is so distrustful of democracy, right? That to argue, don't you trust democracy? Well, a lot of people don't.
Yeah. Well, I think we've come up with a couple of good ideas here, mm-hmm. and I hope someone's out there listening and will take the ball and run with it. But certainly kind of a lively, engaging conversation that we've had this morning. We would like to thank our guests, Jim Shawn and Colin Moore, and we would like to thank you, the listener, for joining in on today's show. And if your call didn't make it on the air during today's discussion, you can contact the Talkback line and leave your comments. That number, 808-792-8217. You can also send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you want to listen back to today's show, check out the conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday, won't you, for more of The Conversation.